a key to the page numbering in the American edition of the Econ and the British edition of the Econ. In case you have the British edition of the Econ, you're welcome to have one of these to be able to find what page number we're referring to. Maybe someone would hand these out to whoever raises their hand that needs them. I don't think everybody needs them, but... Last week we had reached to the point of reading a few of the extracts that Shoghi Effendi has chosen from the whole of the Econ to cite in the letter, The Dispensation of Baha'u'llah, which he wrote as an exposition of the essential verities of the Baha'i Revelation, as a really introduction for the Baha'is of the West to those things that are most fundamental in meaning for the Baha'is to know. And in so doing, he could not, I think, overlook certain passages that he cited from the Econ. To my personal way of understanding, these are probably the very key passages, the essence of the Econ in one sense, that is, with regard to these major truths of the faith. There are many mysteries and endless other subjects in the Econ, which are of importance, of course, but these are very important. So we were reading these together and commenting on them. And followed by that, we're going to examine the passages, 24 passages from the Econ that Shoghi Effendi chose for the gleanings, because that's also a way of, in a sense, identifying very important extracts from the whole book that he thought were of such importance as to include them in this collection of writings that he called the gleanings. We had read a passage on God, the unknowable essence, and I believe we read one here on the prophets of God, the appearance of the prophets of God. I think it's worth rereading that, as that's short, and then we'll go on with the power and sovereignty of the prophets. The door of the knowledge of the Ancient of Days, in this case, Ancient of Days, I understand to refer to God the Essence, the unknowable essence. Baha'u'llah further states in the Kitab-i-Gan, being thus closed in the face of all beings, he, the source of infinite grace, again God, hath caused those luminous gems of holiness, the manifestations, to appear out of the realm of the spirit in the noble form of the human temple, and be made manifest unto all men, that they may impart unto the world the mysteries of the unchangeable being, God, and tell of the subtleties of his imperishable essence. All the prophets of God, his well-favored, his holy and chosen messengers, are without exception the bearers of his names and the embodiments of his attributes. Now, one of the questions last week was, are all the prophets equal? And if they're not equal, why are they not equal? And here, Baha'u'llah affirms that they all are the bearers of the names of God and the embodiments of His attributes. Then he says, these tabernacles of holiness, these primal mirrors, which reflect the light of unfading glory, are but expressions of Him who is the invisible of the invisibles. So it's another title of the manifestation in that sense, expressions of God, expressions of Him who is the invisible of the invisibles. Then he goes on to cite passage related to the power and sovereignty of the prophets, their other qualities. He says, they who are the luminaries of truth and the mirrors reflecting the light of divine unity, and here divine unity again refers back to the Godhead, Baha'u'llah explains in the Kitab-i-Ghan, in whatever age and cycle they are sent down from their invisible habitations of ancient glory unto this world, to educate the souls of men and endue with grace all created things, are invariably endowed with an all-compelling power and invested with invincible sovereignty. And these things are important to know. The one thing you want to note here, that the manifestations of God are sent down from the habitations of ancient glory, is not just a beautiful expression to say that God sent them or created them, but they actually have been sent from another world into this world. Apart from the souls of men, the letters and writings of the faith explain that the soul of man is brought into being at conception and then develops through the body its expression in this world and goes on. That's one stage of its development in the womb. Another stage is its life here in this world after it's born. And the third stage is the infinite stage of its progression in the worlds of God. Contrary is the case with the manifestations of God. Their individual reality, their souls, their individuality has existed prior to their coming into this world. What form it exists, how that form relates to the other worlds, Shoghi Effendi tells us in a letter, we don't know. We haven't been told. But that they pre-exist and that they are sent down from or out of an invisible realm, this he does affirm. Now, Baha'u'llah is given here a dual role to the manifestations of God. There are several different places where you can collect what is the purpose of the prophets of God. Why do they come? And this sentence is one of them. It's on page 97. And he says that they have been sent down under this world to educate the souls of men and to endue with grace all created things. So here you have a double meaning of the role of the manifestation. Educating the souls of men and endue with grace all created things. Now, if you look up in some answered questions the chapter on the need for an educator and the explanation of Abdu'l-Bahá about the three kinds of education, you'll see one of the kinds that he mentions there is divine education. And he explains in detail what the role of the manifestation is with regard to the education of the souls of men. We get physical education in this world from our physical activities and from training of various sorts. We get mental or intellectual education through schooling and the study of arts and sciences and so on. But divine education is of a very special character, and it only comes to us through the manifestations of God. And this is why it's so important that we don't neglect our spiritual education based on the divine words, because this is a transformative education. It's an education which makes out of us another kind of creature, which endows us with another level of perception, which informs us with an intuition which allows us to penetrate unseen realities and superimpose them upon outer existence and derive then from those patterns understandings of our spiritual nature, of our relationship with God, and of those very principles upon which we will act and exist and subsist in the worlds of God to come. That practice, that vision, that comprehension, we're told, is the very reason for our existence, to know and to love God. We do that through the acquisition of these intermediate understandings, which enhance then our appreciation of the role that the grace of God, flowing to all things through the manifestation of God, creates in us. He goes on to say, he also affirms that these manifestations are invariably endowed with an all-compelling power and invested with invincible sovereignty. This is a mystery in itself. It's one of the questions that the Bab's uncle was asking about. Why don't we see the sovereignty of the Qayyim? Because the prophecy said that he would be all-powerful over all things. Mighty would be his role in the world, and so on. And of course, this sovereignty, Baha'u'llah goes on to explain, this divine or spiritual sovereignty of the manifestations is complete, but it's not always manifest as an outer sovereignty, like kings or like rulers. In fact, very seldom does it show itself in that form. And yet the manifestations of God, we have affirmations of the power that they have. Baha'u'llah says, you know, that he could reveal a word or a verse which would cause all men to bow down before him. It isn't that they don't have the capacity to do that, but the arrangement of God is that they should reveal it in such a measure as to test the hearts of men, so that those that respond, those people, those human souls who respond to their message, can be distinguished from those that don't respond. And so that the innate character and goodness of the human soul can display itself in the world. And there seems to...
Then how can they envisage a Baha'i world coming along?
Now this is the heroic age, not the golden age, because there is a stage at which their triumph becomes worldwide. But that's a different phase of it. Now we're told that this is going to really bear fruit. In the past we had a prophetic cycle where there were always references to such a stage. But now it's for the first time we've reached this day of God, and this is the day that won't be followed by night. And so we'll see this kind of worldwide influence of the manifestation. No, not every soul will become a Baha'i, as far as we understand, but everyone will be under the shadow of Baha'i governments and Baha'i civilization until the next manifestation comes, and then he'll develop it further. And then the very nature of existence is hard for us to perceive how that will be. You know, we tend to think what it would be like now if everybody were Baha'is like we are. Well, it might not be a whole lot different than it is. No, it would certainly be different than it is now, but I don't think that's what Baha'u'llah has in mind for the Golden Age, you know, because we got these letters from the Guardian that says that the Baha'is of today, no doubt in the future, it will be 100 times better than, that we are not paragons of perfection, we're just the we are the children of the half-light, the generation of the half-light. And we're trying to raise our heads and we're trying to do our best. And Baha'u'llah is using us as interim instruments, I would think, as formative elements with which to forge something very real of the future. But it progresses with what he's got, you know. I remember hearing that Abdu'l-Bahá had a dream, or not Abdu'l-Bahá had a dream, Abdu'l-Bahá interpreted a dream of a woman in Chicago. She came to him rather disturbed. She said she'd had a dream. He was in Chicago. And she said, I dreamt you were standing downtown in one of those empty spaces between the buildings that people throw old things in. And you were looking through this trash and you were picking up a bit of string and an old ring and a rubber band, and she said, why were you doing, what was the meaning of that dream? Abdu'l-Bahá looked at her and he said, it's all I have to work with. Now Now, be that as it may, I don't know the quality of the story, but I think it has a very real meaning, because Shoghi Effendi has said that really Abdu'l Baha's mission to the West was a failure, not because of Abdu'l Baha, but because of the people's lack of response. Here you have the whole image of the manifestation of God reflected in a human being, which is as near as a manifestation as you're going to get, traveling and speaking to thousands of people the way no manifestation of God is ever done in his own lifetime. The role, the spiritual role of Abdu'l Baha moving across the Western world is yet to be assessed. The influence it will have in the future, the way it will be viewed by the human race in the future. But the response was so little. The people would even get ready to fly out of their seats, so excited with seeing his radiance, and they would write these marvelous testimonies. But after he left, back to sleep again, most of them. And sometimes we see that in the teaching work too. We see people that they seem to respond, or they just need more enkindlement and a longer exposure to the flame before they catch fire. There's this thing that says that dry kindling, when you put a fire to it, it burns right away, it burns immediately. But that which is green, it needs a long time, that you have to have it in the flame a long time, and it smokes a good deal in the process before it dries out. And this is the difference between souls. And then Abdu'l Baha says some souls are like stones. You can heat the stone, but never catches fire. It'll heat up a little bit, but if you take the flame away, it cools down again. So, all compelling power. We can, if we will, transform, he says, a mote of dust into a sun, a drop of water into a sea. And he affirms a number of things like this in the Suratul Haikal, the tablet or surah of the temple. And some of those are indeed cited in dispensation itself. You can find them there. The being all-powerful, still submitting to the way of God, to the wishes of God, withstanding all this persecution, accepting all this suffering when they could just, you know, remove the prison or remove all the enemies in an instant if they wanted to. It's an amazing process that they go through. If you read the prayers and meditations of Baha'u'llah, realizing that they didn't have to submit to this, I mean that they could really, they had the capacity to change anything and everything. You read the story in that's cited in the revelation of Baha'u'llah about a follower of Baha'u'llah who wanted to see him in the prison. He'd come there and he couldn't enter the prison. That was a time when nobody could come. Baha'u'llah, he sees a vision or he has a dream, and he's told by Baha'u'llah to come to me. So he gets up and he comes and he walks to the prison. Through the prison gate, the guards are there. They're looking straight ahead. They don't look at him. He walks through there and walks straight up and walks up the stairway in the back and goes in and sees Baha'u'llah. And amazing. Nobody sees him. Nobody stops him. And Baha'u'llah says, now we've blinded their eyes to you. You can go out the same way you came in. It will be all right. And he goes out again afterwards. I mean, if he can do all these kind of things, you know, he could certainly rearrange the prison, or he could remove Sultan Abdul Aziz, cast him away. This is part of the drama of God that is an education for us who do not have the power, so to speak, to change these things, to submit ourselves to the will of God with regard to persecutions and suffering and tests. And then you can't say, well, it was easy enough for Baha'u'llah to say to do all these things because he never suffered anything because he was a manifestation. Everybody was afraid of him and he could do whatever he wanted. But he wants us to act that way when everybody else will be against us and the people will rise against us. He was the first. The manifestations are the first ones to suffer. So if we do that in their pathway, we're never going to suffer to the degree they suffered. Can you imagine the consciousness Baha'u'llah must have had of the potential of every human being around him? And the kind of grief and sorrow that he would be wrapped in because of seeing them completely ignoring and overriding all of the possibility they had of being in his proximity. to actually cast stones against him, to deal with him in such a way that they would offend God himself? That must be quite a consciousness. If he says he's the wronged one of the world, that no one in history has ever suffered the way he suffered, we have to realize that's because of what he understood, not because of the degree of the physical sufferings. Because we say, well, political prisoners have suffered more torture. Sometimes you hear the Baha'i visitors in Baha'i meetings say these things. We have to understand where he was, the understanding he had, where he was looking at all of this from, to be able, I think, to comprehend a degree of the intensity of his sorrow and suffering. I think that's one of the proofs, isn't it, that's stated by the Master, that they accept all suffering. And of course we see that example in Christ and the other manifestations. Now Muhammad didn't arise to protect himself, he arose to protect the community. So we have a situation there that some Westerners might say, oh yes, but he didn't accept the persecutions. But then that was a situation where there wouldn't have been any word of God or revelation left at all if he had allowed the idolaters to carry on with their plans. Then on page 103, still the same passage. This is from the dispensation 115, page 115 of World Order. These sanctified mirrors, these day springs of ancient glory, are one and all the exponents on earth of him who is the central orb of the universe, its essence and ultimate purpose. From him proceed their knowledge and power. From him is derived their sovereignty. The beauty of their countenance is but a reflection of his image, and their revelation a sign of his deathless glory. Through them is transmitted a grace that is infinite, and by them is revealed the light that can never fade. Human tongue can never befittingly sing their praise, and human speech can never unfold their mystery. This is another basic truth, that we can't understand the manifestations of God except to the degree that their spirit acts and influences our own human reality. In other words, we perceive them within the human station, within the limits, within the compass of our own human capacity to understand them. We never can attain to their degree to understand what they are, for instance, with relationship to each other even. Abdu'l-Bahá, in one of his tablets, he's talking about the love that exists between different levels of creation, like God and mankind and God, mankind with each other, God, the love he has for the revelation of his own being. Then he says there's this special category, which is the love between the universal manifestations of God, because they're the primal mirrors of this light of God. And imagine what kind of relationship they have amongst themselves. And we think of them perhaps as being a few, but Abdu'l-Bahá in another tablet says that these messengers of God appear in all the worlds of God. That every, you know, if we're talking about endless universe and planets all having creatures, the medium for the education of the souls of those creatures is a manifestation of God. This same pattern holds true throughout the infinity of creation. So that, I think there's some hadith referring to 40,000 prophets in relation to this world, to this planet. I don't know. What are we talking about? Endless eons of time and history that have been removed or yet to come. We don't know what it is. But these universal manifestations of God of the level of Baha'u'llah, if you think of them as coming every 500,000 years, it's a very special degree of divine appearance. Now, this is from page 152, 153 of the Egon. Inasmuch as these birds of the celestial throne are all sent down from the heaven of the will of God, and as they all arise to proclaim his irresistible faith, they therefore are regarded as one soul and the same person. They all abide in the same tabernacle, soar in the same heaven, are seated upon the same throne, utter the same speech, and proclaim the same faith. They only differ, and here's the answer to the question that you asked last week. They only differ in the intensity of their revelation and the comparative potency of their light. That a certain attribute of God hath not been outwardly manifested by these essences of detachment doth in no wise imply that they who are the daysprings of God's attributes and the treasuries of his holy names did not actually possess it. So we see that some of the manifestations of God have been called upon to display the divine names in a certain way and others in another way. And the fact that we can't seem to perceive in the history of the life of one of the manifestations, one of the attributes, doesn't mean they didn't possess it. It means that they didn't manifest it. And then another bit of the Agon is wedded into another sentence by Shoghi Effendi, which is a very interesting affirmation. He says, this is with regard to the continuity, the progressive continuity of divine revelation. To believe that all revelation is ended, that the portals of divine mercy are closed, that from the day springs of eternal holiness no sun shall rise again, that the ocean of everlasting bounty is forever stilled, and that out of the tabernacle of ancient glory the messengers of God have ceased to be made manifest, must constitute in the eyes of every follower of the faith a grave and inexcusable departure from one of its most cherished and fundamental principles. So one of the things that we always teach is that there will be more messengers of God, that despite the greatness of Baha'u'llah, he will be followed by a whole series of revelators that will carry mankind to even further heights in their spiritual development and in the unfoldment of the divine civilization which he has come into the world to create. The civilization that he's brought doesn't die with the appearance of the next manifestation, but will be adjusted and further enhanced, we're led to understand from the letters of the Guardian. Again, we're back to the question of the day that's not followed by night.
Mm-hmm. I'm curious to know, when we pass on to the outer kingdom, when we know what's going to happen in the future, will we understand something is what will be?
What do we understand by that? Will we know when we're in the Abha kingdom something about the future manifestations or what will happen here? What is happening here, could we say? Does someone have a text or something from the writings about that? Yeah, okay.
I don't know, but the first part in the Kitab-i Khalq, he said that you should detach yourself from all that is in heaven and all that is on earth. I don't know if that have any connection to your question.
Mm-hmm.
Then all the vials fall away and all the truth becomes apparent to us in the next world. Quoted somewhere, Abu Bahashi.
Yes, I think to some degree, but I think it's progressive. Again, it's not because you don't go to the ultimate, you know, in one go. It's you recognize the light, but then that's to the degree of your receptivity that's been created through your own service and through the spirit of faith that you possess. But you'll see it in a much clearer way, is what it seems to imply. Then you will continue to progress through all these various worlds. You will surely attain each and every one of them, Baha'u'llah affirms. But it takes may take some of us longer than others. I don't know. Please.
Are we supposed to care about what happened in this world when we are? I mean, of course. But I mean, we should detach ourselves from all that is in heaven and all that is in earth.
Mm-hmm.
So, I'm a little confused. I'm supposed to really bother about things like that when we should try to attend the presence of God?
Mm-hmm. Then we'll come back to that. Okay.
Well, the conquerors on high, they are coming to aid us, so they should know what's going on here.
Did you hear that in the back about the concourse on high? If they're coming to aid us, they should know what's going on here. That's a good point. Someone else have a thought on this? A piece of the puzzle?
Yeah, my understanding is so connected by two of a much greater understanding of where the knowledge of what's going on here. But spiritually, they situations of people spiritually rather than literally physically, they need you.
There's a statement by the Master, several statements by the Master, one of which was published when he was in England, where he talks about this, how he says that neither do we forget this world nor the loved ones we have here, and we can retain interest in them and knowledge of them from the other world. Now you can imagine, say you die in the middle of your life and you have a small child left behind and you're concerned about the child's welfare. I mean, you're being has been centered on that during the family phase of your life particularly. I don't think you cut it off easily, you know. Or a mother who loses a child, how she remembers this and how she's concerned about it. These things, they're tablets to cover both situations, about the attitude that the person should have, about what the condition of the loved one that's passed on is, and then what our attitude should be. And in one of the tablets, Abdu'l-Bahá warns a mother to not grieve in extreme for the loss of her child. He says, as it is, it's preoccupying the child in the other world. It's too much, you know. The child will know, or the loved one will know, if the grief is too intense here. And Baha'u'llah counsels us that we should take the middle way in these things. We should be moderate, neither joyful nor too sorrowful, realizing that this is part of a progressive plan of God. We're all moving along, and that we will be reunited, and that we can pray for each other, and that the separation is sorrowful, not to be denied, but not to be clung to the point of disturbing the condition of our loved ones in the other world, should we say. So that gives us some clue. Then the other thing that Abdu'l-Bahá says in this statement, which was printed as an article, is that, as Ayman was saying, that they perceive us in spiritual terms. They can see us, I presume they just as they wish to see us, they see us, they can understand if we are shining with the light of God, if we are attracted in a state of spiritual attraction, or if we're enshrouded with veils. And pray accordingly. Rejoice in our victory or be concerned over our limitations and pray that that the veils can be removed from us, that we can become spiritually attracted again. And we all see in our lives how we kind of, you know, pulse through these two conditions. We're not always in the same condition. And sometimes when we spontaneously turn to them, they can pray for us. Oftentimes, souls in the other world will reflect to us or mediate to us divine grace. Comes from God too, but because of their prayers especially, they shine on us. And the concourse on high is also has more than one meaning. I mean, when we talk about concourse on high, we're talking about souls who have submitted themselves to the will of God so that they are a medium for the expression of His will and what He wants. And in that sense, they're an expression of His Spirit. And Shoghi Effendi explains in one letter that the angels of heaven or the concourse on high are the divine confirmations coming from God. But also there seems to be the fact that detached souls constitute the medium by which God reveals in this world the arts and the sciences and confirms the teachers of the faith and performs a whole series of acts. So we have the central orb of the universe, the manifestations of God shining out on behalf of the Godhead through all the worlds of God, and then we have other souls that have captured that light that continue also to shine, in turn retransmit secondary mirrors So notice he calls the manifestations here primal mirrors. And we have secondary mirrors, which are sanctified human realities, which also intensify the light. So this is a progression.
If you have a loved one in the next world, and you think of them, do you think that there's some communication going on between you two at the time? Like, you really think of them at a certain moment. Are they trying to communicate with you or something like that?
Well, I don't think we, the point of this so-called psychic practices, I think, is to try to hear voices or to try to tap on tables or have something happen that, send a message from there or something. These are things that we're not involved in. But I think that there's surely there's communion of souls. Just as here there's a communion of souls, sometimes when you're not present with somebody, you feel very close to them. And you feel to pray for them, or you're thinking of them in some way, and maybe perhaps they're feeling the same thing at the other end or not. Maybe they'll have it at another time, I don't know, but I think between the worlds this is a reality. I don't have any doubt about it myself, that there are times when you're praying for loved ones that you know that they're looking at you. I mean, you feel that they're there with you, and you become very close and rejoice that they're present. You're not talking to them, so to speak, but it's just there is that possibility. But it doesn't happen a lot. As far as talking to people, it happens from time to time, but not a lot. Maybe it happens a lot and we don't even recognize it because it's happening all the time. Maybe we're sustained so much by the grace of God that we don't even recognize that basically we're alive because of that and nothing else. It's a certain blindness to us. But someone asking, David, who is this? Master? Other worlds of God. You can find the reference to the fact that they are innumerable manifestations of God. There are innumerable worlds and innumerable manifestations of God, innumerable planets, innumerable spiritual worlds. In the Lohia Flakye, I have translations of little bits and things of it, but it's in the first volume of the tablets, Makatib Abdullah. It's called the Tablet of the Universe, and it deals with that in part. Yeah. Mm. No, it's not published, no. It's not translated and published.
What can you get a hold of? Bits of it?
Bits of it? You can talk to Masoud if he reads it and can tell you.
Yeah.
And ask one of the Persian friends who reads it to paraphrase it for you. Yeah, that's very difficult. How is it that the soul, which begins in time, takes on an eternal aspect? In other words, it has a beginning, but eventually it has no beginning. Possess a pure, kindly in heart, that thine may be a sovereignty, ancient, imperishable, and everlasting. Ancient is pre-existent, So once the soul comes into spiritual consciousness, that spiritual consciousness does not partake of time, so it really hasn't had a beginning or had an end. So the soul partakes of that eternal quality. And I don't think from that side, and then from the other side, there's a problem with it. It's just that there is a, as part of God's completeness, as part of the infinitude, if you will, of His grace, new manifestations are appearing in the outer worlds, in the worlds of multiplicity, these lower worlds of multiplicity, progressively, continually. And since there's no end to them, I mean, we can't think in terms of no end and no limits to number and anything like that. So the idea of it to us is, I think, is just to express to us the vastness of God's creation and God's ways and God's purpose and God's method. Maybe that helps us then to focus on our task that we have at hand here in this planet. Mr. Olinga was traveling in Latin America, and I had a chance to travel with him, arranging his trip and translating for him in the meetings into Spanish. And in between, we'd talk about all kinds of things. And he talked about his pilgrimage. And he had a pilgrimage which sounded quite unique to me. He said that Shoghi Effendi, when he came here, he sent him to the Eastern Pilgrim House, the pilgrim house near the shrine, instead of to the Western Pilgrim House. And there was no one at the Eastern Pilgrim House. He was alone there, and Dr. Hakim took care of him. And in that way, he said, Shoghi Effendi came in the afternoon and walked with me in the gardens and took me to the shrines, just the two of us. And he talked to me and taught me all the time. Then he said something which I never heard any pilgrim say. He said also then he would call me to his house in the morning and he would teach me there also. And in a very humble way he said, he taught me all things. He really said it in a humble way, but it was, you know, it just kind of takes your breath away. I remember my hairs in my head went up on the back of my neck. And then I got to think of the implications of that. I said, well, I should ask him about a few things. And he said Shoghi Effendi spoke about this planet. He said this planet was the most backward of the planets of this system. It was really like the tail of the dog. He said, it's still, the people here still make war. And he said it with this great intensity. The guardian said, they still war. Creatures of God, divine beings, slaughtering each other. Quite unconceivable to other realms and other beings. I'm sure we must be quarantined away from proper contact. Now we have to get on with the job. Now that's strictly a pilgrim note, but it gives you a kind of feeling that, you know, maybe we're just about to be pulled out of this slough. There's another pilgrim note about Abdu'l Baha was asked by somebody who believed in reincarnation, you know, something about that how could we not have reincarnation? Didn't Abdu'l Baha believe in reincarnation? And Abdu'l Baha said that no merciful God would make a soul come to this world twice. And then he's said to have added on, he said, for this is the hell of the planets. So if you don't feel so good sometimes, maybe that's the reason. We have the way out. We have the tremendous opportunity because we're at this crossroads between darkness and light. We're at the time of the encounter of tremendous forces of darkness. The lowest stage that the human race has ever been in its entire history, despite all our apparent scientific progress and so on. Baha'u'llah and Abdu'l Baha affirm that the human race has never been in such a debased condition as it is at present. Never. It isn't that it's been coming along all right and now Baha'u'llah is going to finish the job. It's gone downhill at this stage, at this last period. That there is no religion left in the world, that people are clinging to, and they're not clinging anymore either, incrustations, imitations of the divine revelations, he says, with no trace of reality left in them. And that they're just, can you count on the face of the planet the people who can see reality, who can see in a real way the way man's been created to see, that have been spiritually revived and who penetrate things with the eyes of faith and see with that degree, which seems to be the common birthright of men. And yet at this point, the materialism and the forces that are operating in the world have so aborted that that less than 1% after 100 years, less than 1% of humanity has recognized the universal manifestation of God, the most brilliant appearance of God ever to come to this planet. So it's a pretty sorry state. We're fighting our best, but we're still a very early stage of it. But we feel now, you feel these currents, you can tell from the Rizwan message too, the currents and influences of Baha'u'llah's power, the energy that he's released in the world, are entering gradually into more and more of the thoughts of people. Even if their behavior is still off, there's still some spirit of this thing that's coming now into the masses of people. And you get these waves of reaction and of sympathy that sweep across nations and races. All of this will gradually build until it produces the fruit of the lesser peace, which will set the stage for us to be able to do even more intense teaching, and will no doubt, as the cause begins to emerge in a very clear way, will attract to us more persecutions that will enable us to shine in the midst of the trials, and that will call more attention to the faith, and it will proceed then through its various stages of progress until it reaches its destined sovereignty.
In the original message, it talks about how a lot of these Baha'is have been released in Iran, and it seems like some sort of pretty interlude before it all comes back again. All the persecution comes back again, and it gets even worse than what it is now. So what does this brief interlude mean?
Mm-hmm. Well, it may be that way. We haven't seen the downfall of the Islamic clergy yet, of the Shia clergy, and that's promised in the writings. They would be raised up and then they would fall from their height. So we'll have to wait and see what happens there. The unfolding plan of God. Severe as Iran, we don't know how it will be, how the reaction of the people will be. We'll have to wait and see.
And we have no idea of knowing how bad the calamity will be either. How we can do a pray to make them not in trouble.
Yes?
Doesn't the Guardian say that it will be mainly mental tests in the West?
He refers to the Master saying that the believers would be tested mentally in the West, yes, it's true.
We can't even fathom what it's going to be like. But us and for the whole world, right? So it's going to be really terrible.
Maybe. We don't. It sounds like we need some fire to weld us all together. I mean, it's very clear in the Guardian's writings that without something that will purge and weld the human race, this new stage in its development won't be attained. Now, whether that's what's going on now and gradually it will increase in intensity until it produces the desired fruit, or whether there'll have to be things more severe, presumably it's progressively worse, it will be more severe. We'll have to wait and see. Then there is this calamity that's mentioned in the hidden words. An unseen calamity pursueth the human race. This is for its negligence to recognize the manifestation. And that's an assistance so that it will recognize after. We don't know what the character of that is. We don't know what it will be. Shoghi Effendi said it will either herald or accompany all these other ordeals and trials that are taking place in the world. That's really is the essence of it, isn't it? Being far from God is hell, and being near to God is heaven.
So the farther away that humanity gets, the worse it gets on Earth, because there's no ethics left and there's mayhem everywhere. So, I mean, it seems like the future is really bleak for a few years until, it's going to be really rough.
Well, it may be really rough, yeah.
And also, 96 people trampled to death in South America, riots in this country, riots.
Yeah, there's convulsions all over the place.
But people, in the States are saying, oh, sorry, but they're not realizing, and they're not comprehending. So it needs to get even worse than that for people to really realize. I mean, it's going to be really bad,
Read the 1957 convention message of Shoghi Effendi's last convention message. He lists the prophecies of Baha'u'llah and Abdul Baha with regard to the future. And he talks about most of the human race being drowned in the excesses, in the tidal wave of its excesses.
Is that physically or spiritually?
Either way. Well, moving away from the modern scene, back to the doctrine of the cause here. Now, in the gleanings, if you want to take note of the sections of the gleanings which are from the Agon, I'll read them off to you, the numbers of them. These are the Roman numeral sections. You can write them down in Arabic numerals too, I presume, if you can't write Roman numerals. 13, 19, 22, 90, 91, 125, 125, that's it, six of them? Is that what you got? Okay. Now in these six passages, Shoghi Effendi has arranged, in these six sections, Shoghi Effendi has arranged 24 different extracted passages from the Agon. And he's reordered them to some degree too. So that if you try to find the exact matching passage, you'll find you have to skip around in the book to find it, because he's collected parallel themes together in these sections. We'll come back to one of the points that Ben raised, this question of being detached from all things in the earth and in the heavens. But I think this has to do with not being distracted by the goods of heaven as well as the goods of earth. There is such a thing as the goods of heaven. That is, for spiritual rewards, to get all those heavenly goods, would be just the same thing as being attached to things in this world. That we have to be motivated not because of the rewards of heaven, but because this is what God wants us to do. We love God and we want to obey God, and we don't want to displease Him, we want to please Him. And that's all. And if we get rewards along the way, that's fine. And if we get torture along the way, He says it should be the same. You know, perish the lover that distinguisheth between the, what is it, calamity and pain and pleasure in the path of God. Perish the lover who distinguishes between the difference between pain and pleasure in the path of God. It should become indifferent to us. And the manifestation of God gives that example also. Well, that's a very high station, but attachment to God produces detachment from everything in heaven and earth. It's like they're two opposite poles. If you're attached to the earth, you're not attached to God. If you're completely wedded to materialism, you're the farthest you can get from God. But if you detach yourself and you arise by degrees, are attracted to the manifestation of God, and more of your energies and attention and love and affections are centered in Him, then the other things have got to seed. It isn't that you have to cut off your connections to the other things. They will disintegrate. They do disintegrate to the degree that we attach ourselves to Baha'u'llah. This is the way I understand it. You've got the two poles.
You can't just, like, you know, sit by yourself and be detached. You have to deal with the world around you. So how do you bring in detachment? And then, you know, you pray not just to fulfill your spiritual obligation, but you pray to get something out of it. So is that not detachment in itself, by praying to get something out of your prayers or your meetings or whatever?
Is it attachment, you mean? Or detachment?
I mean, is it attachment?
That's attachment to the right thing. So seek ye the grace of God. That's the one you're supposed to be after.
But then isn't that attachment to the kingdom of names or something like that?
I think kingdom of names in most of those passages refers to this world and its titles and distinctions and so on.
So if you pray for the grace of God, it's a different thing altogether.
You pray to draw closer to God, to He's created us to know Him and to worship Him, to recognize His light. So we want to draw close to Him through such means.
But in the Seven Valleys, this Baha'u'llah says that even the light is a wheel in front of God.
Is a what?
It's a veil.
A veil in front of God? Yes, in another tablet he says that the truth, or the true one, is covered by many, many veils. First there are the dark and gloomy ones, and then there are the lighter, more luminous veils, and then there's the veil of light itself, which has to be overcome. You can see why there's something, some deep chords, I think, were struck in people by the Star Wars movie. Because there is some element of all of this. You know, there's some of the real element of fighting the dark force and overcoming that and becoming a spiritual knight, so to speak, moving ahead. And yeah. Okay, before we go into this gleanings passage, I wanted to just read this opening paragraph of the Gaon itself. On page 3, Baha'u'llah says, "In the name of our Lord, the Exalted, the Most High, Aliyul Allah." This is the title of the Bab. These are titles of the Bab. And as he was speaking as the Babi here, he invokes the name of God, those titles which have encircled and enhanced the Bab himself. My understanding again of these things. And I'm telling you all these things now, I have to be careful. But you should just understand these are my understandings. I'm not saying that this is the real meaning of this unless I can produce another text. But I can tell you Aliyul Allah is the title of the Bab. And in a message of Shoghi Effendi to the Baha'i world, he says that the battle cry of the hosts of the Baha'is in the crusade, he gave a battle cry. He said, "Is Ya Baha'u'llah Baha, Ya Aliyul Allah." This is Ya Aliyul Allah. This is Aliyul Allah, that title. And it's a title, it's a call to Baha'u'llah and a call to the Bab for assistance and support. "In the name of our Lord, the Exalted, the Most High, no man shall attain the shores of the ocean of true understanding except he be detached from all that is in heaven and on earth. Sanctify your souls, O ye peoples of the world, that haply ye may attain that station which God hath destined for you, and enter thus the tabernacle which, according to the dispensations of providence, hath been raised in the firmament of the Bayan." He says the essence of these words is this: they that tread the path of faith, they that thirst for the wine of certitude, must cleanse themselves of all that's earthly, their ears from idle talk, their minds from vain imaginings, their hearts from worldly affections, their eyes from that which perisheth. They should put their trust in God, and holding fast unto Him, follow in His way. Then will they be made worthy of the effulgent glories of the Sun of Divine Knowledge and Understanding, and become the recipients of a grace that is infinite and unseen, inasmuch as man can never hope to attain unto the knowledge of the All-Glorious, can never quaff from the stream of divine knowledge and wisdom, can never enter the abode of immortality, nor partake of the cup of divine nearness and favor, unless and until he ceases to regard the words and deeds of mortal men as a standard for the true understanding and recognition of God and His prophets." Now this refers again back to this question of vain imaginings in the first paragraph here, earlier in the paragraph. this is literally veils of glory, which has the meaning of vain imaginings, and it goes back and forth in the book in various passages. These veils of glory are the things that we think are true, and which we take pride in our knowledge, which actually are the means of keeping us back from God. And until the soul understands that it has many things that it has to strip away, until it's willing to examine the premises upon which it bases all of its beliefs over and over again, this question of cutting through and attaining to this kind of knowledge and understanding that he's talking about here, and this level of grace, suffusion of grace, is not possible. It says as long as he regards the words and deeds of mortal men as a standard for true understanding and recognition of God and his prophets. Now, here we've got the uncle of the Bab who's been steeped in the teachings of the Muslim clergy about how the Promised One will come. He's having some problems with the way the Bab came. Why? Because he's acquired this learning. He's taken into himself these views of the clergy, which were wrong, about what the manifestation, what the return of the Qayyim would be. And by harboring those particular limitations and prejudices, is unable to recognize the truth. Now, this is the state of many of the people of the world, although I think Baha'u'llah in this century is pulling them all away from religion. You know, there are forces which are now, at least those kind of veils have been reduced. Now we have the problem of science as the end-all, or materialism as an end-all, and that's replaced their new idols of another character, but I think they will be more easily overcome than these religious ones that were there and kept the people completely blinded. Although there was the fact you could argue with them, you could bring proofs from traditional proofs from the holy books, and you could win an argument and you could win a believer. But now, in this day, if you do that, you go through this pattern of people who apparently are firm in their religion. Even if you can defeat them rationally, they won't accept, still won't accept. Mostly they'll just turn away and really be annoyed that you've shown them to be deficient in some way. But in Iran, the great believers that they brought to the faith, who were, you know, enemies of the faith, were won in debate, in spiritual debate. They would see the superior wisdom of the Baha'is with regard to their own holy books, with regard to their own teachings. He could outdo them on the field of explanation and exposition, and that would attract them. They would say, well, this man knows more than I do. Sure. The best example, maybe. One of the best. Now, the shores of the ocean of true understanding. This true understanding, and also the sun of divine knowledge and understanding further down here, and on the next page, true understanding and recognition of God. This refers to this condition of attainment to Irfan or Marifat. It's a different kind of knowledge from the knowledge that's acquired by book learning or by study. It's a perception. It's an immediate recognition of something. In other words, one kind of knowledge, say if you had heard of fire, that would be one kind of knowledge. If you'd never seen fire, but you'd heard of fire, you'd heard a description of it, that would be one thing. Another degree of knowledge would be if you actually saw fire. That would be quite different. What a difference between hearing about it and seeing it. And if you get in and burn in it, that's another stage of another degree of comprehension. So the point is that this is a living knowledge. This is an immediate knowledge. And again, you can refer to some answered questions where he talks about two kinds of knowledge. One is this immediate perception of things. You know whether you're hot or cold. You don't have to be taught. You know, somebody doesn't have to go through a book with you to tell you whether you're hot or cold. You know this thing. There's some things like that that you have immediate perception of. This type of spiritual perception of the spirit of the manifestation of God is that kind of immediate perception. If you have it, it affects you. It stirs the inner being of the soul. It shakes the foundations of human reality. it blows through the breeze like a breeze, like a gentle breeze, through the leaves of the tree of your spirit, and it sets everything aglow and moving. Abdu'l-Bahá says, you must attain to spiritual susceptibility, sensitive to the spiritual breezes that are wafting through the soul from the presence of the Beloved. Or you must be warmed by the heat of the Sun of Truth that's shining on the soul. And that this, far from drawing back from spiritual feelings of that sort, this is one thing that you should move towards. Now, we're all of different character. Some of us feel these things more intensely than others, I think, by endowment, not just by divine gifts. Because some of us, by nature, are more emotional than others. Some of us, it will appear in us as deeper wisdom and an appreciation of the perception of truths and understandings that will excite us. Others will be more of a swoon, you know, something. It's like the difference between the valley of love and the valley of knowledge that we're told about. There are different stages even in our own lives, the way we'll react to these things. But ultimately, I think that we resonate to them in accordance with the degrees of divine names that are part of our own being, with the dominant names of God in our own reality, which are different in each of us. We all have all the names, but we have them in different proportions. So the expression of these things in us will be distinct, one from the other. In fact, distinct every one from another. But there's still similarities. Different but the same. And he says that what is the connection between God and man? He says this is the ecstatic connection between a lover and the Beloved. Ecstatic connection. It's not something we're likely to miss if it happens to us. And this is the goal, is moving towards this clearer perception of love and vision of the divine reality and the manifestation of God. And he's right there, he tells us, at the door of the heart. Just the face of God is right there, it never disappears. In fact, his grace is never cut off. What's cut off is our nose. I mean, what's cut off is our perception of the thing. It's right there, and we're not always finding it to the degree that we should. And reading these texts and reading the promises of the tablets sometimes has the effect of leading to frustration. We're frustrated. What is this? That's very good for that frustration is excellent. We're supposed to be restless. Why is it we can't attain to these things? What does it matter that I don't feel these things the way I'm supposed to, or the way it says in the book I'm supposed to feel it? That kind of restlessness is not going to hurt anybody. So get out and serve more and do everything we can and be patient with ourselves along the way and trust in God and beg him to help remove the veils and to show us what the reality is so that we can move forward through these various degrees of closeness to God, of nearness to God. And let us not forget that's the task we're about. That's why we're here. That's what we're here for. And as we do that, the people, the other souls that are nearer to God, we become closer to them. Because the God is in the center, we move towards him, we move towards each other. It isn't as if we are, as you would say, going away from people because we're drawing close to God, so we're cutting ourselves off from the people. We get closer to the people, not farther away from them. We feel more tender about other souls and helping them and trying to do something for them. This is what the writings tell us as we do that. How can we love God and abandon man, so to speak? It's the love of God that will really help us to serve each other and to, in a sense, be examples to each other. So nobody has to shake a finger, but just by the way we are, others will want to be like that. Or they will see how it is, because they see it embodied in someone. I think this has been one of the great services of the hands, when they are in their really mode of teaching and speaking, and it's such a change, you see such a transformed individual there, that it gives you the idea of, oh, this is what it is that I've been reading about. Because that's how do we know, you know? Well, I promised to stop at 9:45, and it's 9:50, so I think we should perhaps call it an evening tonight. But next week we'll take up some more of these themes, and maybe we'll look at the outline. And if you have continued to note down the themes as you're moving through the book, I'll eventually pass out a set of these, but I don't want to give them to you too soon if you're actually searching out these themes in the book.
How many lessons are there then?
Originally there's probably be 5 more, but I think it's something like that. It depends how fast we move.
How many themes?
There's nothing happening after this. There'll be some other thing, so it can stretch on. Amen with that.